Good morning to you in the name of Jesus. You may open your Bibles to the Revelation chapter 5. My wife asked me if I was going to preach from Revelation this morning, and I said no. Well, first she asked me where I was going to preach, and I said I'm going to preach from the book of Ruth. And then she said, are you going to preach from the book of Revelation? And I said no. And I think both of those answers are correct. And maybe we will understand that as we go along. In chapter 5 of the Revelation of Jesus Christ, it says that they sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and had made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. And it's interesting about how we think about the book of Revelation, because certainly much of it is about perspective, because if you were here this morning and you weren't saved, then it would be about judgment. And if you are saved, then it would be about grace and mercy. Because like it was already mentioned this morning, I think Brother Dale said, or someone said, he said it one way and I'll say it another way, that in life, Jesus is our priest. He's our lawyer. But in the end, he will be our judge. So if you're here this morning and you're not saved, then certainly at the end of time, Jesus will be your judge. And even for a Christian, in many ways, he will be a judge. But there's mercy and grace for one group, and there's judgment, meaning destruction, for another group. That's a pretty important perspective. I like to preach from the book of Ruth. It's probably one of my favorite titles, and I probably have preached various parts of what you might hear this morning here before. I'm not sure about that. But this verse in Revelation is about redemption, and that's what the book of Ruth is about. It's about redemption. And of course, that's what the whole Bible was about. It's about redemption. And story after story after story after story. And the Bible says that the Old Testament is for examples. And I understand the scriptures, as I understand the scriptures, that most of the stories, much in the Old Testament is just stories. And the book of Ruth is a story in one picture after another after another, and they have meanings and they have thoughts and they give essence. From the very beginning of the Bible all the way to the end of the Bible and the consummation, like we were thinking about this morning, you have stories after story after story. You have Noah and the flood purging the earth. And Peter says, the flood is an antecedent of what is coming. Peter says the flood is an antecedent or a pre-story of how it will be in the end. And of course, we have the Revelation where it tells about the day of the Lord, where God will that time purge the earth with fire. And Peter says the first time he did it with water, and the second time he will do it with fire. So many, many stories in the Bible. Most or all of the stories in the Old Testament are pictures and stories that are going to be real. And they were real, but they will be even more real. Picture after picture. In the story of Noah, we have the record of fallen angels who, in licentious acts of immorality, in attempt to devour the human family was an attempt as an antichrist, an attempt to defile the human family that Jesus Christ would not come and die for you and I. And of course, Jude says and Peter says, both for their evil and terrible sins, that group of angels are already chained in darkness. There's another group that are not chained in darkness, but that group is chained in darkness. You have the picture of Daniel and the Hebrew boys. And you have the antecedents. You have the pictures of the Antichrist that would come. And John always says it's already in the world. You have the picture of Goliath, an antecedent of the full-blown Antichrist that is yet to come. And you see this happening. We see it happening today. As I understand, the Antichrist system is a wholesale effort to eliminate or destroy righteousness. That's what I understand it. We have the picture of Esther and Haman. And there again, you have a picture of an Antichrist, Haman, who was trying in an attempt to destroy the Jewish seed so that Jesus could not come and be the Redeemer. Repeated over and over and over in history. People call them types and shadows. Well, we know that the end time system is ramping up all around us. Sodomy and wicked immorality. The only point I'm making about that in some points here are that these things are not coincidence. What is happening are not coincidence. The transgender evil that's happening in your world is not a coincidence. See, there's a verse in Daniel where it says that the Antichrist will be a homosexual, transgender kind of an individual. It says he shall not have the desire of women. So what's happening? The ball is just rolling up. Real events. Waves and pictures of what is yet to come. And then when you think about the revelation of Jesus Christ, it's either judgment or mercy. See? It's safety for the believer. So if you're not here, if you were here this morning and you are not saved and know you're not saved, even though you're a member in the Mennonite church, if you're here and you're not saved, you ought to be terrified by what's happening in the world. You ought to be terrified by that. And you ought to get right with the Lord. If you're here this morning and you know that you're not right with God, then you ought to be terrified with what you see happening in the world today. Every day, it's ramping up. So we have all these beautiful pictures in the Bible, and I want to go to the book of Ruth, and you can turn there a while. We also have the beautiful pictures of Abraham and Isaac on the altar, and the ram in his place. And it says there, right in that scripture, and it says, this shall be seen, and on Mount Moriah you shall see this thing take place. When the ram was caught in the thicket, and he was used for the sacrifice, the very next words of God are, in Genesis 19, it's beautiful, it says, I think it's Genesis 19, I didn't have this in my notes. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. In other words, the very thing that he said to Abraham, the very thing that you saw here is going to happen on Mount Moriah. It's all about redemption. So, you see that all happening there in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. He was both the sacrifice and the substitute. He took Barabbas' place that night. So, just a few thoughts. And the book of Ruth is a picture. It's a very, very beautiful picture, and I want to think about some of these thoughts this morning. The central woman in the story of Ruth is you. And the central man in this story is Jesus Christ. Now, there are a few things that should interest Bible students, those who want to know and understand the Bible. One is that these stories are pictures and examples. But secondly, all those things are a progressive revelation of who God is. And the revelation, see, Christ is not finished yet. There's even more revelation of him yet. And as we were wrestling in our Sunday school lesson, we don't even understand all that. But the book of Ruth is a story. There are 39 Old Testament books. There are 27 New Testament books. There are 40 books named after men. Pardon me. There are 40 books in the Bible named after people. 38 of them are men. And there are only 2 books in the Bible that are named after women, Ruth and Esther. And only 1 book of the Bible was named after a godly woman, and that was Ruth. It is my personal understanding, and I do not believe, that Esther was a godly woman. There are too many immoral things and too many ungodly things were happening in the book of Esther. I do not believe personally that Esther was a godly woman. That might surprise you, but I don't believe she was. I think the book of Esther is a picture to show us, in much the same way that God is preserving the Israeli state today in all their ungodliness and wickedness for some purpose. And we have the book of Ruth and the story of Ruth, the story of Esther. And through that experience and through that circumstance, he saved the Jewish race, that Jesus would come. And Haman, as an Antichrist, was attempting to destroy that race. But God didn't let it happen. So that's the one book named after a woman, and the other is the book of Ruth. And she, as I understand, was not a Jewish woman. She was a Moabite woman. So in the book of Esther, I understand, so we have 40 books named after people, 38 of them men, two of them women, and the one an ungodly woman, and the one a godly woman, or became a godly woman. So the book of Ruth is a story about a woman. Have you ever thought about how many other stories were happening during this time, and God preserved one for us? And there certainly were other godly stories. But she is like a... This story is like Luke chapter 13, where it says there was a fig tree planted in a vineyard. A vineyard is for grapes, but here was a fig tree. So here you have a Moabite woman that's planted in the Jewish story. Very beautiful. And you're quite aware of this. I'm not telling anything new. These are just old stories. She was a Moabite, a Gentile, which became part of the story of Jesus and adopted by marriage through faith. Now, if we were to turn to Matthew, we would find 4 women in Jesus' genealogy: Tamar, a Gentile Canaanite. It means fifth in Hebrew, or one called out. She was a harlot that Judah had an incestuous affair with, and you can read about this in Genesis chapter 38. The Bible tells us that story, and it was inserted right in there while Joseph was down in Egypt. We had this story. It's not a pretty story. It's a very ugly story. In Genesis chapter 38, where Judah went out with a Canaanite woman and had children, sons, and he took a wife, and then he went and had an affair with her, and her name was Tamar. And yet the beauty is, it's there in the genealogy of Jesus. Tamar, a Gentile Canaanite. inserted in to the Hebrew story. The second one you'll find in Matthew, if we were to go there, is Rahab, a believing Gentile harlot who had a love affair with God of the Hebrews. And she became the mother of Boaz. And the third woman in Jesus' genealogy there in Genesis is Ruth, a Moabite, and there's nothing but beauty. And that's the story I'm thinking about this morning. And the fourth woman in the genealogy of Jesus is Bathsheba. And she was a Jewish woman who committed adultery with King David and became the mother of Solomon. So here we have story in the book of Ruth about a woman who was a part of God's plan. And so when you think about all those strange stories, bringing together the Jewish story, and then we read that story, we read there in Revelation, and I don't know if you believe that that song that's being sung, I don't know exactly how you believe the chronology of Revelation, whether you believe that's before the rapture or after the rapture. But the point is they were singing about this whole plan. They were singing about this whole story. And Ruth is a story. As she was brought in. Now, we could read the book of Ruth in about 30 minutes, if I were to read it, or maybe 20. Some time ago, last fall, I think, we traveled to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, and I think it was a show, and I think it was drama, but it was at least interesting to me. This young lady was in this huge auditorium, and this young lady stood on the stage, and by memory gave the whole book of Ruth. Now, she gave it in a version, not the King James version, a more contemporary version, but I was impressed. And not only that, I was favorably impressed, because as she unfolded it, it was a beautiful story about how Ruth, the Moabitess, was taken into the family of God, and that was the point of it. So I'm not going to read this book this morning. It would take a half an hour of our time, and there are some points I would like to make out of it. But it is a beautiful story. Joshua Judges Ruth. It is a beautiful story with many details, and it was during the time of the judges when no one was in leadership. And it says that during the time of the judges when no one was in leadership, and when everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes and what seemed to be the right thing to do, we have this story. And we know that everyone doing what's right in their own eyes never works well. You know, even churches try that approach sometimes. But the point here is there was no strong leadership, and here we had a man named Elimelech living in Bethlehem, which meant house of bread, but it was famine and there was no bread. And this one family decided to give up. And his wife's name was Naomi. And he had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And there's many things that we don't know about this story. Was Elimelech a godly man? What do you think? Now, we heard this morning that already that if he just trusted God, he would just stay in Bethlehem. But he didn't stay in Bethlehem. He went to Moab. Took things in his own hands. And I think of the many times that I've taken things in my own hands. And I don't always know when I should take it in my own hands or when I should leave it to God, but I think we should always leave it to God. And he didn't leave it to God. He went over to Moab. I guess one of the questions in my mind is, why did Elimelech not trust the promises of God? Why didn't he just trust that it would come out okay? But as the story goes, he took his situation in his own hands. And He seems so much like the prodigal son who went out to find more instead of just trusting God. But the text doesn't give us a light on that. We only know that it was a time without leadership and everyone decided to do their own thing. But I'm convinced that even in that situation, here and there, there were faithful men and women who stayed in Bethlehem. But this one family decided to go to Moab. And of course, Moab was the land of the Moabites. Now we know that story. The Moabites, we know how the Moabites originated. They originated from the story of Lot and then two girls back in Genesis 19, where two girls took it in their own hands because it seemed like there was not going to be a heritage. You know, this might surprise you, but I don't even know if God held those two girls and Lot accountable for that sin. I don't know for sure if he did, because the Bible does say that he winked at their ignorance. I'm not making a big point out of that. It's just saying that they went into the land of Moab, which was a very evil nation at that time, and a constant enemy of Israel, and settled down over in the land of the Moabites. That's the story we have here in the book of Ruth. And then tragedy struck. Elimelech died, and Noemi had two sons with her. And then suddenly, tragedy struck again, and both young men died. And so now Naomi had only her husband, or had neither her husband or her sons, and she was a widow. And she was left alone with two Gentile daughters-in-law, and no grandbabies to carry on the family line or to cherish. And she was alone in a pagan village. And what was hoped to be gained by doing their own thing suddenly took wings and flew away. How often does that happen to you? It happens to me. Often, by running ahead or outside of God's will, what we think to gain, we lose. And yet God was over all that. It's a story of faith. And then the famine was over back in Bethlehem, and they remembered and decided to go back. There was hope back there. And then we have this story, and Ruth has her two daughters all out on the road, it seems like, and the one said, "I'm going to go serve God," and the other said, "I'm going to go back." You know, as we know the story, Ruth's life bloomed into the family of God, and we don't know what happened to Orpah, but I have run across a legend, and I know we can't teach or preach legends. That's not the point. But there's a Jewish legend that says that Orpah became the mother of Goliath. That she went back home and took a prostitute life and had many suitors and many men, and that Goliath was her offspring. Now, I can't teach it over the pulpit because the Bible doesn't say it. It's only a legend. But the point that I'm really making, that two ladies had a decision to make and a choice, and just like going this way, no matter what happened. And you know, I'm only in my 50s, but I'm old enough now to have watched through Bible school and through church life where two young people who seem very much the same and seem to have almost the same opportunities and the same privileges, and they started to make choices, and the one went back and the other went forward. Even unseemly youth sometimes who has seemed like they didn't even hardly have the right pieces to go right. And yet, so the point I'm making is, I don't know if it's true if Orpah became the mother of Goliath, but when you see the feud that was going on there, and when you think about the grand scheme of, well, I'm making too much out of that because I don't know if it's true or not. But still the point is, there was a choice to be made, and the one went one way, and the other went the other way. And once you start separating paths, and once you start going right, Men's easier to go right. Did you know that? And the way, and once you start to go wrong, it's easier to go wrong. And so by the choices of life, that's just the way it comes out. And when you think about Ruth, and she seemed to be so full of faith and so determined to go, and she says, I'm just going to go. And she certainly didn't know what was going to happen. She certainly didn't know what the future was. She certainly didn't know. But she went. Maybe Ruth had told her about the Redeemer law in Israel. I don't know. You'll find that in Deuteronomy 25, where the Redeemer needed to buy back the woman and the ground. But as the story goes, they went, and Ruth went to glean in the barley field of Boaz, and it says it just happened. It just happened. Well, we know that's not true, and that'd be some of my points a little bit later on. She happened in the field of a wealthy relative, maybe a cousin or a brother to Elimelech. And he must have been a very kind man, because after all, he was the son of who? Who was Boaz's mother? Does anyone know? Adrian, you know. It was Rahab. So now Rahab was another kind woman, a woman of faith who had come into the family of God. So it would be expected, probably, mothers, if you're a kind woman, you'll probably teach your... Okay, if you had an experience like Rahab had and came into the family of God, it would go almost without saying that you would teach your son and daughter the beauty of being accepted in to the... Anyway, here she came back, and she came in, as the story goes, and she happened into the field of Boaz, who was the son of Rahab. And that's an interesting part, kindness to all those who come in, because Ruth was a Moabitess, and she did not belong in the family of God, not for at least 10 generations, the Bible says. But the grace of God will always come to those who desire to be part of his family. And it would seem to me, I can't teach this because the Bible doesn't teach it per se, but you know, there's often more between the lines than what is in the lines. We have to be careful with that. But because mother was Rahab, it seems to me that Rahab must have often spoke about it. And Boaz understood this thing, that a Gentile could come in. And looking out over the crowd, I don't think there's any Jews here. I don't think there are any Jews in this crowd. I think that all of us are Gentiles, see. And we needed a way in. And that's why, I'll just say it. That's why I believe it's serious error to believe that the church replaces Israel. Paul says don't do that. The point is that we got a way in. We got in. And during this time of the church age, you and I have a chance to get in. Because in this setting, Ruth got in. So, there's some more lessons here. God often has ways of doing things that are outside of our ways of thinking. Anyway, we know the story went on. She had dinner with the reapers. And Boaz gave her the leftover meal. She took it back to Naomi, and there's a full bushel of wheat. And she tells Naomi the story. And then Naomi gives her that strange way of proposing to Boaz to be redeemed. And we have that nighttime story. It's there. I don't know what to do with all that, but it is a beautiful picture. And we know that Boaz accepts and redeemed Ruth. And he went through the process there at the gates of the city, and he married this young Moab girl. And it must have been a very happy time, and Ruth bore a child. That's the story. not all of it, but the biggest one. And what we have is that Boaz is a beautiful picture of Jesus. The law required that the Redeemer must be a kinsman Redeemer. And we know that Jesus was a kinsman Redeemer. Man was given in the garden. Man was created to be the king of the earth, and to rule over the earth, and to give names to the animals and so on. But he lost his inheritance in Eden by selling it out to Satan. And only a kinsman redeemer could redeem that situation. Only by death and blood of a man could the situation be redeemed. And of course we have that in Romans chapter 5, 17 through 19, the second Adam, that was Jesus Christ. Only by grace. Only by grace as Gentiles. And we didn't get in because our family was Jewish. We didn't get in. We don't have salvation because our family was Jewish. We don't have salvation because we grew up in Mennonites, as Mennonites. We have salvation because of the second Adam, that was Jesus Christ. And because there was a kinsman redeemer to come. And because Jesus came down to die. And he became our blood and our flesh and our bones. And that's what those saints were singing about in Revelation chapter 5. Our elder brother, Hebrews calls Jesus. And he's able to save us to the uttermost. And he became our high priest. He was holy and harmless and undefiled and separate from sinner and higher than heaven. And it says in Philippians chapter 2 that he came down and became obedient unto death and made himself of no reputation. So in this law of redeeming that Boaz did for Ruth, he needed to be a kinsman. And of course, not only that, he had to be able to pay the price. And of course, we knew that Jesus could do that because he was sinless. He was wounded for our transgression. And third, the Redeemer must be willing. And we know that Jesus was willing. The Bible tells us that. And so I just have a number of points from all of that, which is just this big story for everyday living. And I have one, two, or three, or four points here. This story this morning is an incredible story about how God uses those that we think it's impossible to use to accomplish his purposes. I ask you this morning, is that you? Or do you somehow feel, or do we somehow feel that somehow, well, sure, God would use us to accomplish his purposes. See? But God used this woman. And the point I'm making is that God uses the impossible to accomplish his purposes. See, the story of Ruth was written probably, or most certainly, was written by Samuel. Now, have you ever wondered, like I've wondered, why was King Saul crowned king, but he wasn't from the correct tribe? He was from the tribe of Benjamin, correct? But we already had the prophecies that the king would be from the tribe of Judah. So why did God insert King Saul? In fact, he even promised him a dynasty. He told King Saul, if you're faithful, I'll give you a dynasty. And we have this story. The point is that Samuel, who wrote this story about Ruth, he mourned and he pined about that all, but God told him to get up off his face and go on. And even though he didn't understand, he did it anyway. He went and anointed King David. And this disobedience of King Saul is so sad. In fact, God took away the kingdom from him and his posterity and gave it to David, the proper tribe. Why of all that? Well, I don't know the answer. But it fits in this whole story of Ruth. If you have your Bibles open and to Ruth chapter 4, you'll notice something very interesting. David, who was the grandson of Ruth, was a 10th generation from Phares. Phares was the son of Tamar, the illegitimate child from Judah, way back there in Genesis chapter 38. So you have, it says, it gives the generations right here. Now these are the generations of Phares. Phares was the son of that situation with Judah and Tamar back in Genesis 38. Phares begat Hezron, 2. Hezron begat Ram, 3. Ram begat Abinadab, 4. Abinadab begat Nashon, 5. Nashon begat Salmon, 6. Salmon begat Boaz, 7. Boaz begat Obed, 8. Obed begat Jesse, 9. And Jesse begat David. And the Moabite couldn't come into the congregation of Israel for how many generations? 10 generations. So I find that quite interesting. Now, was Saul a fill-in in the big plan? Where do you want to go from here? I hardly know what to do with that, but it does cause me to fall on my face. Here's why it caused me to fall on my face. What if you, as a Gentile who were brought into the family of God, were only a fill-in? For a big picture. See, I don't know if Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion's were fill-ins or not. But one thing I know from the rest of the scriptures, we don't have time to talk about this morning necessarily, but we are talking about them. One thing I do know, that whosoever will can come in the generation of which we live, in the church age. Anyone can come in. And listen, let's not forget who God is as we think about this big picture that we're thinking about. Anyone can come in and anyone can stay in. So we don't need to fret and worry about being a fill-in. And yet, that should really charge our hearts, because if we are not faithful, we may just become a fill-in. Wouldn't that be sad if there's someone sitting in this audience who once knew Christ but fell back from Christ and just was a fill-in? So my point is, this story about Ruth is incredible in multifaceted ways. And it ought to just really charge us in the world in which we live today that is ripe for judgment and mercy and grace. Because God, none of us need to be anxious that we are fill-ins. But all of us should be anxious about faithfulness, that we do not become fill-ins. And I don't know if there's something seems to say. And I said this some time ago, and a brother said, well, preacher's been, I don't think the world's any worse than it ever was. It's just, and he went back and used the Roman world and how the Roman world had all the things that our world has. And I have to agree with that. But finally, I didn't know what to do with that. Except, but I said, at least you know this. It's 2,000 years closer. Now, what are you going to do with that? The day of the Lord is 2,000 years closer. You have to admit that, at least. Furthermore, please don't tell me as a preacher that they've been saying that for years, because Peter says that is a serious error to say that the preachers have been saying for years and years that it's going to keep on going. And Brother Dwayne, you and I are supposed to be preaching that it's not going to keep on going on. See? Peter says that the scoffers are the ones that say, well, it was like that back in Rome. Don't use that. Well, I'm going to keep on using it. Is that okay? I'm going to keep on using it because Peter says, don't do that. Don't be like the scoffers that say, well, it's just the same as it was back in Rome. At a minimum, it's 2,000 years closer. Number two. So it's this incredible story. Number two, as I think about this whole story, and we don't have time to talk about all this morning, God is a sovereign moderator of events. And I know some of our friends take that and use it for election, and they use it for once saved, always saved, and all that. And yet, I think sometimes as Christians, and when we place a lot of focus on choice, I just did that. I just went past that. And I believe it's right to place a lot of emphasis on choice. However, I think sometimes we do lose, in that emphasis, we lose just the sheer fact that God is a sovereign moderator of events. And when you think about this book, that 10 generation thing, that thing about Elimelech going over there and the sons dying and all the things that happened, that story. There was a simple man I heard not long ago, and first I thought his devotions were just simple, and the truth is they were simple. And he used a verse from Psalms for his devotions, and it was pretty short and pretty brief and all, but the more I thought about it, and his thought in the devotions was wait on the Lord. It was wait on the Lord. And so in my critical mind, first I thought, well, that's pretty simple. But then I repented of that because it is pretty critical. Wait on the Lord, see? Because God is doing all this even while we talk. Sort of an extension of the former point. Number three point is that how in the story of Ruth, and I already mentioned it, how our actions have such far-reaching consequences. They just go on and on and on. See, this whole story, I was going to say it was a result. It's not a result. That's not correct. But at least it's interwoven. It was a result of Judah's sin. Would it surprise you if I would say, I don't even know if Judah was saved by faith. The Bible doesn't tell us he was. He was of the son of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He was one of the 12 sons. I don't know if Judah was saved by faith. I don't think he's in Hebrews 11. I don't think he is. But maybe he just wasn't mentioned. The point I'm making is that my actions have such far-reaching consequences. Many generations there. And then you have Ruth coming in. And David becoming the rightful king. Number four this morning, we being Gentiles can come in because of grace. We being Gentiles have redemption. Number five this morning, God has always stepped forward to save. It was always his plan. It was always his plan. Now in the old covenant, the man came in by the nation of Israel. In the New, and it says in one of the Old Testament prophets, it says twice or three times, I don't have that marked down here, that the Jewish nation was the testimony, or it was the witness to the world. Now, in the New Covenant, we know that the people of God, 1 Peter chapter 3, ye are God's chosen people. We become the light in a city set on a hill. The point I'm making here is that God has always stepped forward. It has always been the mind and the heart of God to save people. And that ought to be our heart too. And this whole picture of Boaz and Ruth is a beautiful picture of grace. And as I understand the scriptures, one day there will be an ultimate fulfillment of this, of that whole picture, as Boaz as Jesus, grace for a Moab woman who could not come in 10 generations, but she got in anyway. She got in by faith. She got in by her choice. She got in by her decision. She got in because of sovereignty. She got in by her choices. But one day, there will be an even ultimate fulfillment of the book of Ruth. And it'll be a grand event. I believe that because point number 6, God will keep his side of his covenants. See, in the story of Boaz, in the story of Ruth, Boaz was the Redeemer. And Jesus is our Redeemer. He's made it possible for the redemption of both the people and the land. And this is my prophetic view. See, when Boaz bought Ruth, he had to buy her and the land. That's why the other Redeemer didn't do it. He only wanted the land. But in the story of Ruth, the true Redeemer, who was Boaz, he had to buy her and the land. He bought both. So as I understand the scriptures, he says that he's going to make a new heaven and a new earth. And as I mentioned earlier, Adam sold this old earth to Satan. The Bible says that there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. I don't understand this. But it says a city that comes down. I don't know if this city is going to hang above this earth and we're going to be able to go back and forth. I don't know how this is going to be, but it is my understanding and belief that this whole thing that's coming for our grand finale fulfillment is going to be quite real. If I stood and preached to you here this morning that hell was some kind of a mystical something that didn't feel good, you would call me a false preacher, rightfully, right? So in the same reality, in the extremity of reality, is that what hell is. If I were to preach hell here this morning, I would be preaching and teaching that we were going to feel and see and smell. We would go to Luke chapter 16 or wherever we would go, and we would go all through the scriptures, and we would teach and preach in this congregation this morning that hell is a true reality. You'd agree with that. Well, I think the same about this grand finale that's coming up. I don't know all the details, but he says, and then Bruce talked about it this morning. Bruce, when he's talking about the city, that's just talking about the holy city which come down from above, right? It says, and it talks about the streets and the gates, and it says there's no need of the sun on this, but it says a new heaven and a new earth. And I just understand this, and I think it ought to inspire us in some way, because I think that the new heaven and a new earth both will be very, very real. Very, very real. We're going to keep on studying here in Revelation. It was in our lesson this morning a little bit. It says the tree of life is there, right? 12 manner of fruits. Each month, there'll be a different kind of a fruit. I don't know if it'll be apples, cherries, peaches. I don't even know what you like, but whatever it is, you'll like it. So the same tree that was in... Okay, what I'm teaching and what I believe is paradise regained. Does that make sense to you? And that God is a restorer, and he's going to restore this whole thing. And yeah, there'll be many differences. I'm sure of that. But God is a covenant-keeping God, because Paul says if he wasn't a covenant-keeping God, and he was, then he's a liar, and then we should be out boating this morning. That's the reason I'm not outvoting this morning, is because God is not a liar, see? So we're here together to worship. He says your faith would be vain. That's what he says, Paul says. Okay, in the story of Ruth and Boaz, okay, so if I repeat it too often, you forgive me for that, but if I don't, you might say I didn't understand. In the story of Ruth and Boaz, Boaz must restore both the land and the individual. That's what I believe about the end of this age in some way. That God is going to restore both the people. He has bought the people, already has. It's going to be a marriage supper of the Lamb. And create a new heaven and a new earth. That ought to make us want to do it. That ought to make us want to do it. Jew and Gentile alike. Of course, that's much more preaching. Jesus came once to redeem the people and to open up a way for all, the Gentile and the Jew alike. And the next time he's coming to be a judge. And he will purge this world with fire to create a new heaven and a new earth. You can find this in Peter, where he says the first time he did it with water, the second time he's going to do it with fire. I don't know whether it's going to be all brand new earth or whether it's going to be like the flood where he's going to remake it. I don't know. It would make no difference to me which way he will do it. But Peter says, and he likens it to the flood. In either way, I believe that the scriptures are true. So you see, my wife said, are you going to preach about Revelation? And I said, no, I'm going to preach about Ruth. Now, which did I preach? See, what's going on in the world that we are in, there's a squatter. Do you know what that is? There's a squatter sitting here, and he has usurped the earth. That word's not coming into my mind, but he's one who came in and squatted on the land. He came in and stole it. He came in and became the king of it, the prince of it, the power of the air. And he came in and he took what was not his, and he's squatting on it. And this kinsman redeemer, this Boaz, who is willing and who has the credentials. See, Satan does not have the credentials to be squatting on planet Earth. But he did it anyway, and that's why 18 more Germans were shot yesterday. It's becoming so common news that we don't even know about it. But 18 more. He's a squatter. But this kinsman redeemer is going to come, and he's going to cast the squatter and all of his angels into the hell and the lake of fire, along with all those who are the children of that king, into a lake of fire that burns with fire and brimstone, where the worm dies not and the fire is never quenched. And so those thoughts for us this morning. I think we need to keep reminding ourselves that what is not the final reality. And that's the revelation of Jesus Christ yet. Who he is and what he will be is given to us in words, but the actuality of it, the revelation of it, is yet to come. There's a fuller reality of Jesus Christ. Let's kneel together for prayer.